Hi and welcome to the Provider Podcast by NHS Providers. My name's Adam Brimelow, and in this episode, we're talking about race equality in the NHS. Black History Month has added fresh impetus to the dialogue around race and discrimination in our society and the health service. But it's really important, isn't it, that these issues are recognised and addressed at all times, and to ensure we move beyond talking to doing to deliver real change. NHS Providers is working to support this, both internally in the way we work as an organisation, and with our members supporting trust leaders in championing diversity and tackling structural racism and discrimination. I've been talking to NHS Providers Deputy Chief Executive Saffron Cordery about this work, and hearing from trust leaders about developments on the front line. We have Ifti Majid, Chief Executive at Derbyshire Healthcare NHS Foundation Trust, and Steve McManus, who's Chief Executive at Royal Berkshire NHS Foundation Trust. So we'll start our conversation on race equality and leadership in a moment. But first, let's have a quick foray into recent NHS developments with Saffron Cordery. No surprise that we'll start with COVID and that Joint Select Committee report, which highlighted key failings and, it should be said, achievements in response to the pandemic. Saffron, what do you think was the most important lesson to learn for the possibility of a future pandemic for the NHS?
I think there are two things I take from that really compelling Joint Select Committee report. And the first one is the power of locking down as quickly as you can. I think that that's one of the most significant findings from that report, which is that we didn't lock down quickly enough. We didn't lock down as fast as other countries. And so from my perspective, we saw the power of that. It's not a popular move. No one wants to see it, but we know that lockdown is incredibly effective. The other thing I would say that report points to is the sheer ability and brilliance of the NHS actually to turn on a sixpence and actually completely transform its service to deliver something that it's never had to do before, which is to cope with a major pandemic. And that for me was incredibly compelling. And that's not just what our colleagues in hospitals did, which was completely astonishing, but it's also what we saw in terms of mental health delivering digital services, in terms of ambulance trusts completely stepping up to the mark and really doubling their output and using 111 really effectively, and also community services really supporting discharges from hospitals in quite a significant way. So we saw some real changes there, not just from organisations, but from the staff that work in them.
And we also had the monthly performance figures, didn't we? A reminder, not that we needed it, of the huge pressures that trusts are continuing to face.
Absolutely. And I think that this is probably one of the big challenges right now is the performance dip that we are seeing. But it's, you know, it's not a sudden dip. This is an ongoing decline. And you know, it sits alongside rising COVID levels, which brings a real challenge. We've got growing elective waiting lists, but we've also got huge demands in mental health. I think the one ray of hope that I take from this is that we are making inroads into those who have waited a year for their procedure or operation or test, but you know, we know that things are incredibly challenging. And the reason is that we are dealing with COVID. We are dealing with a huge spike in emergency care. And we are also dealing with a waiting list that as soon as you move someone off of a waiting list, two more people join it. So we are in that really difficult place. And that's not to say that trusts are doing less. They aren't. Activity levels are actually up. So yeah, a challenging picture on the performance figures.
On now to our main topic for this podcast, race equality in the NHS. In a moment, we'll hear from two trust chief executives who've been working to improve leadership and deliver improvements in Black, Asian and minority ethnic staff and patient experiences. But first, Saffron, what's the work that NHS providers are looking to do on race equality to support trusts and also within the organisation?
So race equality is an absolutely top priority for NHS providers as an organisation, but also for the sector that we represent. And I think it's so important that we spend the time to focus on this. So what we are doing in NHS providers is working with three really great race equality advisors and a fabulous programme manager to develop work which will support trusts and trust boards in particular on their own race equality journey. But also, before we do that, what we are looking at is NHS providers as an organisation. And we were quite rightly challenged to say, you can't be supporting trusts until you've done your own work. And that's what we're doing at the moment. We want to make sure that we are working as not just an organisation that says that racism is unacceptable, but to be an organisation that is anti-racist. So we have done our own internal work to look at a kind of overview, a snapshot of where we're at. We're not too proud to say that we've got some challenging areas that we need to look at. And we are all undergoing that process of understanding what it feels like to be from a Black or minority ethnic group within NHS providers, to understand what it feels like to be at work, but also what it feels like to live in our society and understand how what goes on in society also goes on in our organisation. And that's absolutely critical. And we're just doing that work at the moment, and it's difficult. And any organisation that's done this will say it's difficult. The other thing we are doing is starting on the process of talking to trust to understand what they want from a support and development programme, because that's the first place that we need to look. We need to understand where trusts are at, what they want, what they need. And alongside that, we have also surveyed them, and we will be getting the results of those surveys pretty quickly, which will help us to really pin down where we're going to take action. But some of the things that we've heard from trusts already include the fact that they want support from us in a number of areas. And I think that includes things like helping them to create a safe space and forum for discussion so that they can challenge their mindsets and also share the challenges and learning amongst themselves so they can really challenge each other. We know the power of that peer challenge and understanding what others have gone through and bringing your own contributions to that debate. We want to be able to share best practice, and particularly the evidence of those really high impact interventions from within the NHS, and also looking at what's worked in other sectors, because we know that it's not just about the NHS. If something's worked really well in education or criminal justice or in the private sector or the voluntary sector, let's learn from it, adapt it for our context and our setting. And I think one of the things that we know that is really important to boards is for them to have being anti-racist and race equality really embedded in their own governance. So we are thinking about how we develop race equality as a core part of board business and strengthen accountability for that. And I think that, you know, that's really important, and it forms really a thread through the work that we have done already supporting boards. And I think it's really important that we have both that kind of interruption and a new focus, but also that continuity between the work that we've done. I think the other area I would focus on is that alongside supporting trusts, we are also bringing a race equality lens to how we critique policy and how we influence on behalf of trust. So not just looking at what does a particular policy mean for, say, finances or governance or quality, but actually looking at it from the equality, diversity and inclusion perspective and saying, how does this policy support or undermine that? And really taking it to the centre of our influencing work.
Safwan, you mentioned we've been talking to trust leaders as part of this work, and we thought it would be useful to share the perspectives of a couple of trust chief executives whose focus on race equality is really making a difference. First, Ifti Majid from Derbyshire Healthcare NHS Foundation Trust, who told me how, as a board, they made a conscious decision to move beyond following what could seem like a diversity checklist to a more proactive pursuit of real inclusion.
There's lots of things that are telling us these are the sorts of things that you can do. These are the things that have an impact. The thing that started to bother me is that it could feel like a checklist and therefore become static. And actually, if you complete those things on the checklist, you've ticked diversity. So does that mean that that becomes less of a priority for boards? Whereas inclusion, there is something about continually improving, continually striving for inclusion, always needing to do more, feels like it's a much more active word to me than diversity. And that's the conversation, Adam, that we've been having at our board, very much about how do we make that move from saying not being racist isn't enough. Actually, we have to be anti-racist. Not being discriminatory isn't enough. We have to be anti-discriminatory, which means taking action, taking overt action and continually taking action. And I think that's why we've shifted away from that concept of diversity, where you could say, actually, you know, looking at the criteria, our board is diverse. But actually, you're never going to say, that's it, job done. We are an inclusive board, because it's something that you're always going to continually work at. So I think that's sort of that's why we have moved away from using diverse. And actually, in our organisation, we talk about inclusion. We have a director of people and inclusion, as opposed to somebody that heads up an EDI sort of function.
Yeah, so I suppose what you're really talking about here is really challenging mindsets in a more fundamental way. What sort of approaches, as part of that, have you found to be most effective?
You need tactical stuff. You need medium term stuff. But if we are going to be or create organisations that are truly inclusive, that's about sustainability, and sustainability comes from cultural change. And actually, the cornerstone of cultural change is having a conversation about what it is that drives each of the individual members of a board to want to become more inclusive. What that means is spending some time thinking as a board and as individuals in the board, thinking about our heritage, thinking about the personal messages that we all carry around. You know, if I think about my personal messages as somebody that comes from Pakistani heritage, you know, I think about messages to do with working harder. I think about messages maybe that my father would share with me as a first generation immigrant around, no, don't rock the boat. So I need to understand those messages to understand what influences me and therefore what type of leader I'm going to become, or I am, or I want to be, and what works for our organisation. So having these conversations, you know, within an organisation are really, really important. And having these conversations in a board is the forerunner to organising and thinking about, well, what's my inclusion strategy going to be? Because if we don't know why it's important to us as individuals, how can we explain to the organisation why it's important and why we need to do something differently? So there's the part of sharing personal stories that is all about the board defining why it wants to be inclusive. But there's also part of sharing personal stories that is about it's a really effective way of learning of people within an organisation. In fact, much more effective than sheep dipping through EDI training, because what you're doing is you're having conversations with people who you know, and you're hearing their experiences, and that lands in a very different way than something that's a bit colder. You know, traditional training can be a bit colder.
Yeah, so you talk about the importance of a personal testimony there, and then I suppose you then look at various areas of where the sort of additional insight could be applied. And I know an early focus for you was in terms of recruitment. What did you do there?
I suppose recruitment is a great example, because we started conversations at the point of realizing that we needed to recruit somebody. We have conversations with relevant networks within our organization to say, how do we best shape this job description? How do we shape this person specification to get to make it broadly attractive so that we're not excluding people? So you actually start at that point, and then you move to, you know, then you move to thinking about are there things that we are doing in the way that we traditionally, you know, advertise or recruit for these vacancies that actually exclude people? Then there is an issue about how do you create a challenge within the process to make sure that the process is inclusive. And we in our organization have trained something called Recruitment Inclusion Guardians. We've now trained over 100. And these are individuals whose sole purpose right from the very start of a recruitment process is to challenge the recruitment team, as in the team that are coming together to bring somebody new into the organization. Around, are you thinking diverse? Are you thinking about how you can attract diverse population, how you can be inclusive, how you can ensure that that we're not inadvertently excluding members of our local communities? So these recruitment inclusion guardians sit right from the very onset, reviewing the job descriptions all the way through shortlisting, right through to the final panel. So I think they have had that's a real impactful intervention, I think, along with thinking about how do we give more recruitment emphasis to some of the groups that we have, you know, some of the stakeholder groups and things like that, because quite often they are seen as being advisory in inverted commas. And actually, you get some really important emphasis, some really important information from those groups. Putting all of those things together makes the recruitment process feel very different indeed. And has it been successful? Well, I suppose if you look at the last four board appointments that we've had, three of them have come from our BME communities. So that does suggest that they're working.
Okay. So you bring to this, obviously, your personal experience as a leader from a minority background. You talked a little earlier about your personal thought processes. Looking to your colleagues across the board and the organisation in securing and embedding this process across the organisation, how important and how challenging is it from your perspective to really get buy-in, support and leadership from your white colleagues?
I mean, this I think gets to the heart of what we're talking about, Adam, in terms of making change sustainable. So, you know, having lived experience doesn't necessarily mean that I or other BME colleagues are the people that can action and make change. You know, we can contribute to that, and we must avoid the classic often used methodology of, oh, well, we need to do carry out some change that links to ethnicity. So let's bring IFTY in and see if he can lead something. Actually, you know, the vast majority of decisions are made by white leaders. Just based on pure numbers, and therefore you know, allyship is something that is really, really important. And I think we need to separate out experience from responsibility for change. Both are really, really important. And you know, one of the biggest challenges I think for allyship is that it's not a graduation, is it? You know, it's not something that you've done and you tick. Actually, it's an ongoing learning that white colleagues will have. If we're talking about ethnicity, it's a lifelong process, for want of a better phrase. It's all about growing. It's about learning. It's about understanding. It's about amplifying the voice of, you know, our BME communities in this case. That's why it's so important. And therefore, as an organisation, thinking about things like how do we support the telling of stories is really important, because that helps those roles. How do we think about the involvement of allies in our network? So our networks are open to allies, because actually that's how you give the opportunity to grow and to learn and to ask those questions in a safe space is really, really important. And there is also something about having conversations that say what allyship isn't, you know, and about it not being about I'm here as a white person to save our BME colleagues or things like that. That's not what it's about. It's not about speaking for. It's about speaking alongside. But you need to have these conversations, and the best place to do that is in some of the networks.
Interesting there that IFTY concluded they're talking about the value of supported networks. I think that's come through, hasn't it, as part of the feedback we've had in conversations with trusts.
Absolutely. And the power of networks, the power of groups of people supporting each other, and that collective input, that collective support is absolutely critical. And I think it's a key tool that we must seek to support and promote.
Well, let's hear from another Trust Chief Executive, Steve McManus from Royal Berkshire NHS Foundation Trust, on the work he and his board colleagues have done to engage with and support ethnic minority staff to understand and respond to concerns and create an anti-racist environment. Steve described how this work has evolved over the last 4 years.
One of the really pleasing things is, you know, having set up the BME Forum back in 2017 and myself with Don Fairley, Chief People Officer, you know, really convening that forum, you know, we've moved away from being conveners and we now participate in a network which is self-managed and self-sustaining in terms of from within our BME community. So that's a really important aspect of investing in the conditions around which colleagues from within the BME community can kind of take control of the agenda themselves and start to direct that. Reverse mentoring, or inside the organisation, Mentoring Plus is a scheme, is really where we've specifically looked at bringing senior leaders together with, you know, more junior partners, but junior partners from, a BME background, to work together in a mentoring relationship that works both ways. So a number of our senior leaders at executive level and board level and other areas within the organisation have been working with a long-term mentoring relationship with a BME partner. So I was being, you know, mentored by a BME colleague from one of our admin teams, really to understand better her experiences of working in this organisation, her experiences as a member of the BME community within this organisation, and trying to get a better sense of some of the daily experiences, blocks and barriers that she may experience, potentially due to her ethnicity. And equally, you know, trying to provide some direct mentorship for that individual, you know, from my perspective. So I learned a huge amount and about some of the reasons why colleagues from our BME kind of community may not feel they're able to progress in terms of career opportunities within our organization, often down to how the kind of Anglo-Saxon method of recruitment actually culturally is insensitive to the way that some colleagues from a BME background feel that they can project themselves in terms of their own skills and capabilities. So that's really helped us to think inside the organization? How do we look at recruitment and selection? How do we look at the kind of traditional ways of interviewing? And how do we think kind of differently about unlocking the opportunity for colleagues from diverse backgrounds to present themselves in a way that's most effective?
And you've talked about these initiatives that you've obviously had a hand in helping to develop and support. How do you see your role as a white leader and white ally of colleagues from Black, Asian, minority, ethnic backgrounds to really create an organization that is clearly anti-racist and making tangible strides in terms of race equality?
So I think in a leadership role, you have the privilege to be able to use your platform around the things you do, the things you do say, but equally the things you don't do or don't say, to recognise that they have an impact. So I absolutely see my role as a leader within the organisation, as a white leader, to create the conditions for honest conversations about what it feels like to be Black or Asian heritage, or to have English as your second language, you know, within, you know, my kind of organization, and to try and create the conditions to engage, listen, understand what the experience of our colleagues from those backgrounds are like. Openly talking through my blogs and video blogs about these kind of experiences, openly talking about inclusion in the broader sense. When I do my back to the floors, I do a back to the floor each week, and drawing out the kind of relevant opportunities to talk about those colleagues who work in corners of the organization that people often don't see. So our housekeeping staff, our catering staff, who do amazing job, are often from BME backgrounds with English as a second language, and to really shine a light on their experiences and to talk about that kind of openly in terms of within the life of this organization. I was really struck by an article from Nova Reid, where she was kind of reflecting on how after, you know, the murder of George Floyd, you know, she was inundated from white friends, colleagues, for her input. And she described something as performative allyship, which I think is a really dangerous place to be. So when we talk about white allyship, I think it's really around, you know, having that honesty about, you know, your own contribution to changing the experience of racial discrimination, being able to genuinely use the platform that you have to create conditions that are more positive for colleagues from a BME background that you, you know, have the opportunity to influence, and say doing that consistently and persistently as part of just the way that you lead.
Really encouraging there to hear the determination to deliver tangible change, because I think it's fair to say there's been a lot of discussion in the NHS on race equality, hasn't there, but not always backed up by action.
Absolutely. And I think as you say, is critical. We need to reflect, we need to understand, but we also need to act, because as the phrase goes, fine words butter no parsnips. It's the actual action that is critical, and that action can be understanding, but it can also, and importantly, must mean making practical changes to reflect what you've heard.
So you talked about NHS providers' commitment to this area of work. What step by step are the sorts of things that we can expect to see in the coming weeks and months?
So what we are going to do at NHS providers is to collect everything that we have heard from trusts up and down the country about their challenges, where they need support. We're going to pull them together into a program that we will launch in the coming months. And at NHS providers, we will also be continuing our focus on our own development and our own journey, and make sure that we embed race equality throughout all of our support, influencing and policy work.
And I believe there's also going to be a session at the forthcoming annual conference and exhibition as well.
Absolutely. So that's not where the conversation starts. That's where the conversation continues. And I hope that everyone listening to this podcast who fancies coming along does sign up to that session.
Thanks for that, Saffron. And that brings this edition of the Provider Podcast to an end. Do listen out for the next one, which will look in more detail at what's coming up at NHS Providers' annual conference and exhibition. And remember, you can join in the conversation by following us on Twitter and LinkedIn at NHS Providers with the hashtag The Provider Podcast, and keep up to date on future episodes by subscribing to the podcast. Thank you.